Am I optimizing for shipping a feature as fast as possible? Am I optimizing for shipping a feature as securely as possible? Am I optimizing for shipping to learn information as much as possible? Am I optimizing for spending as little money as possible? I think everybody's going to make a decision on a certain context, saying, you know, this is an internal facing app. This is an IT. I can trust everybody who's got this deployed because they're sitting in the office next to me, versus this is something that is going to be accessed by our most powerful customers. This is something that is processing personal health information. This has regulations. This has actual financial effect on people. I think where you draw that line depends on how something is going to be used.
Welcome, everybody, to Defender Fridays. My usual pitch here is, we love to talk with people that do all kinds of different things in the defensive side of cybersecurity. And that's kind of an envelope that's growing. I feel like every week there's a new aspect to what the defense and cybersecurity means. So we want to make that circle a little bit bigger, bring in people for the discussion. So it's not meant to be a slideshow at all, right? This is really meant to be a discussion about interesting topics and discovering new things. And on that, on that theme, we've got Shane with us today. Hey, Shane, do you want to do maybe a quick intro?
I'll be happy to. Thank you. Hello, everyone. I'm Shane Warden. I'm principal architect at ActiveState. Been at the company almost 7 years. I've been an open source since the late 90s, so I was around when some of the internet as we know it didn't exist and was being invented, so I've seen a few things. Also been in open source for many of those years, so I've seen a few things, done a few things, made a lot of mistakes, and hopefully have a perspective that will help some of you learn from my mistakes without having to make them yourselves. So very happy to be here, very happy to chat.
Love it, love it. I love the spirit. That's we all learn by making those mistakes. So the more mistakes we've made, the better we are off. I think you wanted to chat a little bit today about AI assisted vulnerability reporting, like around that topic. Do you want to start a little bit of that conversation?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, one of my basic theses of how software development has worked the past 25 years is if you look at what like free software open source people are doing, you're a few months or a few years ahead of what people are doing in professional capacities. I remember scraping together a Linux box, putting it under my desk again in the late 90s, putting it on the network, realizing that it was an open SMTP relay in the corporate network and I could get access to the internet there. And fast forward a couple of years, and now that company's deploying everything on Linux servers. And that's wonderful. But, you know, realizing that so much of what we have in the world today starts as shadow IT, shadow development projects that people realize I'm doing this in my side project, I'm doing this in my off hours. I love the productivity gains I'm getting. I love this tooling. I'm going to bring it into my system, whether it's the Linux kernel, whether it's Git, GitHub, things like that, whether it was Ruby on Rails development, things like that. People are out starting businesses, people are optimizing things there. So my thesis is what you see in the open source world where anybody can contribute, where the guardrails are off, you're going to start seeing people adopt some of those practices, some of those tools, some of those techniques, some of those libraries in your corporate environments. And so we need to pay attention to that because people are learning lessons there, people are making mistakes, people are also learning things. And it's not a monolith, but what you're seeing there, you're going to see in your own operations here soon if you're not seeing them already. So I'll start with that thesis, and then I want to get into a specific example I've seen as an open source maintainer that was really eye-opening. So this was before the announcement of Mythos, which is, of course, Anthropic's model, which I haven't seen it, I haven't used it, but according to reports, it's very good at detecting and chaining vulnerabilities in software. What I saw in one open source project where I have access to the security mailing list is a couple of months ago, a group of people sent in a security port. They used all of the standard responsible disclosure mechanisms, GPG signatures, addressed only the signature, the signatories, things like that. They sent us a list of about 90, 95 vulnerabilities that they had purportedly found and summarized there. And of course, we looked at this and said, we have to take this seriously. We have this mailing list set up for a reason. We want the security information here. But something smelled funk to us, right? I mean, getting a whole list of 95 of these things is amazing, right? You know, no human being is going to sit down and compile this list and say, oh, I've got three or four. I'm just going to keep going. You think a good security researcher is going to say, I want to prioritize these, find the best ones. And after two or three, I'm going to say, all right, we need a longer engagement here. But we looked at them. And the initial scan I did was, okay, there are some things here we need to look into, obviously. And then a week passed and we were still looking into it, right? Open source project, maintainers doing this in the free time, and the disclosures became a little more heated. Why are you not fixing this? Why are you not taking this seriously? Hey, we've got some code over here that you should bring into your project because we've already solved these things. So again, my is this fishy detector keeps going up and up and up. And of course, hey, we're volunteers, we're looking at this, we have to investigate this, we'll get back to you. Thank you for your report. A week or so later, here was the punchline. We're going to disclose this if you don't pay us $100,000 that your open source project doesn't have. And, by that point, we had already, as the maintainers, discussed this and thought most of this is AI slop. Most of it is, legitimately, if you did this and this together, no, this isn't going to happen because this is the way the project actually works. It was, I think, a context unaware misunderstanding of how the project has to work together. But two or three of them, right? Two or three out of this 95 were actually things that were not high vulnerabilities, as they said, but things that legitimately could and should have been fixed, which is a terrible percentage. But I look at this and think three things, right? Number one, this is going to happen over and over again. The ability of anyone with an interest in looking at a project, looking at source code, whether they have access to it legitimately or not, we'll talk about that in a second. The ability to look at these tools and produce this report is accelerating. It's going to keep happening. Number two, even though we have maybe a 3.5% legitimate rate here, I can't ignore this vulnerability. These are things that absolutely have to be fixed. My time now has a demand on it because these tools exist and these tools are widely available. And number three, you got bad actors at parts of this. Maybe not starting off as bad actors, but there are enough people, enough tools, and things like that that we cannot protect ourselves by saying we're going to outrun this. We need to think about how do we save ourselves from all of these disclosures, all of these vulnerabilities, all of these purported vulnerabilities, and things like that. This project could have reputational damage, even though it's not true, by someone putting out a press release or making a nice marketing page and a nice logo like Heartbleed or something like that, and saying Project X now has this cute name that is absolutely vulnerable. You should not do it. I could suffer reputational damage from that. Your company could suffer reputational damage from that. So there is something going on that is concerning, and I don't know how to outrun that. And that's one of the things I want to talk about here, right? Practically speaking, we have seen a change in what it means to have source code available, what it means to have tools that can analyze source code available, and to do this at scale that is not bounded by a human being sitting and thinking very deeply about how do these two threads interact.
It's fascinating. And the other possibility that I thought actually initially you were going to go at, or that it was going to go this way, is for those bad actors, as they're ramping up the pressure to actually go and say, here's patches fixing the things.
Right.
Meanwhile, they're just, ways of introducing vulnerabilities, like ways of kind of lowering your defense, right, in a way,
Right,
and
right,
merging.
right.
That's yeah. That's it's all very scary. I'm curious to two things. So one is, you mentioned, open source kind of being at the front edge of this. So I'm curious, if and what kind of defensive mechanisms or like what you're thinking about in terms of defending against that. I know I've heard like murmurs of, the old like proposal many years ago around. Hey, what if we charge like 1 penny per million email, right? So that like to
Right.
reduce spam and like there, there's interesting things there. The other part that I'm kind of curious to get your take about is, I wonder, as a, more as a thought experiment than anything, but someday Mythos or the equivalent is going to get released. And what GPT-4 is to us today, someday Mythos is going to be to us. And so I wonder if that problem ends up getting, you know, caused and solved by just the newer LLMs coming out that eventually get so good that somebody that wants to produce that report, it's not this kind of contextless garbage, but it's, you know, what it finds is actually right, the good things, right? Which would be kind of an interesting way of solving the problem. But where is that today for you guys?
One thing we did without getting into a lot of details is we took a sort of adversarial relationship. And I don't mean this, you know, just these people seemed a little suspicious. I was wondering, is this going to be like an XZ type of situation where these people really want to get code into a repository, and then 2 years down the line, we're going to realize they laid the seeds for something malicious there. It was adversarial in the sense of, well, you've got robots doing this. We can have robots doing this too. And because we know the code base better, we think we can probably prompt our robots to give a better response to what your robots prompted. So it's sort of that, you know, okay, we're going to use computers to solve the problem that computers created, which I think, you know, in our development work at ActiveState as well, as we've gotten more agentic development and things like that, having something like Cloud Code actually implement a specification and then having something like Copilot review it as we make a pull request on GitHub, we've seen them argue back and forth, and 80% of that is actually pretty good. You know, that 20%, that might dip down to, you know, like 5% where we really need a human to be a typewriter on that. But so far, I think, you know, the solution, like you were alluding to about, you know, sending email and spam, you know, it was cheap and easy for me to send, and I'm not saying it was do this, but I never did this, but it would have been cheap and easy for me to send spam from 100,000 compromised computers and spend the CPU time of many other relays trying to detect this. Or those relays can get together and say, we're just going to make a block list, and any IP address that looks suspicious, we're just going to drop this, right? We're going to solve the problem with using computers in a different way. Or you take like the spam assassin or the Bayesian approach that Paul Graham proposed. There's sort of a tick-tock situation here where a computer is creating a problem and then a smart use of a computer is solving that problem. I'm not sure what the computer solving the problem is beyond, you know, adversarial, use an AI to detect the output of an AI and think about that yet, but I think there probably will be, because this is how evolution happens in the internet over the past 30 years. You know, and the other thing that I'm gonna charge you a penny to process your email. Well, you fast forward that a couple of years and we get Bitcoin, which has its own pros and cons. So these things just, they build on each other. And I'm curious to see what the reaction is that is not a social reaction, because I think that's probably the most effective right now. But what's the technical reaction? And it might be that our models are arguing over the code for each other and they need a human as a tiebreaker. Maybe. Okay. Mm. That worked out okay for us, but we had the specific context, you know?
Yeah. As just a total aside, you just dropped the thing casually that I thought was actually super interesting. I think a lot of software development shop at this stage, you know, will use AI review and AI assisted, you know, development. But the idea of going kind of one level of recursion beyond that, of saying, you know, the developer and the reviewer are actually going to be in a loop, right, arguing with each other about the design and coming to an agreement. It's super cool. Sounds also very expensive, but no.
Well, you know, it's the question is what you want to optimize for, right? Am I optimizing for shipping a feature as fast as possible? Am I optimizing for shipping a feature as securely as possible? Am I optimizing for shipping to learn information as much as possible? Am I optimizing for spending as little money as possible? And I'm over-exaggerating all four of those. But I think everybody's going to make a decision on a certain context, saying, you know, this is an internal facing app. This is an IT. I can trust everybody who's got this deployed because they're sitting in the office next to me. I'm you know, managing something in their spreadsheets. I don't care how much this gets done versus this is something that is going to be accessed by our most powerful customers. This is something that is processing personal health information. This has regulations. This has actual financial effect on people. I think where you draw that line depends on how something is going to be used. And the nice part about, you know, all of these tokens, all of these machines is they're going to get cheaper next year. They're going to get better. The value toward cost ratio is going in our favor. So I don't like to say wait a few months and we'll outrun the bear because there will be a bigger bear, a faster bear, a scarier bear, but our current bears will look less scary in comparison, which is also nice. Today is the worst these models will ever be. Exactly true.
Yes, I like that way of putting it. Yeah, there's many bears coming. So on the, kind of back to the open source side of it, do I understand correctly that like right now it's sort of at, if I think of the life cycle of this problem, it's you're saying like, hey, we're starting to live this problem, but we're not, if I think conceptually, I would expect, we're starting to live this problem. We live this problem continuously. We have a solution that we try, and then it kind of goes
Right.
on. So are you at step one there, or are you already at step two where it's just that playbook that you mentioned now is just like happening over and over?
I think there's no concrete agreement on how we treat AI-assisted coding in the open source world. You'll see a project like the Linux kernel saying, I accept AI contributions as long as a human being actively signs off on this because that human being is responsible for the output of what they submitted to the project. You'll see other projects like Zig saying, no, the most important part is creating new contributors who actively understand the code base, they understand the culture, they understand what we're trying to do, and we're going to reject anything that doesn't look like a human was in ownership of this from start to finish. And I can understand both of those perspectives. They're both reasonable perspectives. I can understand, a project like Curl saying we are blocking vulnerability reporting just because we are inundated with one of these things. You think about a project like Curl or OpenSSL or libvirt or SQLite or something like that, where you get something malicious in there and you have owned possibly billions of installations. I understand how they would draw their lines more differently from someone who's writing, I don't know, software to control arcade machines or something like that. I mean, not that I don't care about security there as well, but that's a niche that SQLite is not.
For sure, for sure. So do you have a thesis for how you think, like how you're thinking? Look, my expectation, I should say, is, you're probably not you as in like you specifically, we are all probably going to hit step two at some point where it's just ongoing. What curl is living, everybody kind of like ends up living. Do you have any thesis, any thoughts on how, either you specifically in the context of that project, or in general, if you prefer in generalities, like you want to approach that, or is it still like, hey, we see it coming, we don't really know how, you don't have a thesis yet on how to fix it.
I don't have a thesis yet how to fix it because I don't know what the solution looks like. We don't know if we are going to hit a singularity or asymptote on these models continuing to get more and more capable. And we don't know if we're going to have adversarial tools. And again, not adversarial as in, dangerous, but being able to work these tools against each other at a scale that humans can't. We don't know what that tooling is going to look like, right? Again, with the spammers, they didn't realize that they were going to get people to block to band together and make block lists, for example. And that's just a sea change in how email routing works over the internet as a whole. I don't know if there's going to be sea change like this when and where. So there's something there. But I think we also need to think about how do we protect the other code we have in our organizations, right? I mentioned before, I think this started, that there are still organizations, I believe, dealing with the effects of log4shell. Just because they can't necessarily or don't have the capacity or don't have the understanding of rooting out every vulnerable instance of Log4j2 in their organizations. There was a report, I think Indoor Labs put out recently, that said like 81% of organizations are making open source malware a top priority, and only 21% of them actually enforce any protections about that as well. So you have people understanding the problem, and you have people figuring out ways to address the problem. And those are two very different numbers. I worry not just as an open source maintainer, but as a consumer of open source software, as a user of software that consumes open source software, that what we are seeing is the tip of the spear in terms of what's vulnerable. I don't have to be an adversarial actor to run a malware scan against something like Django. and then try to extort the maintainers of Django. I can keep that to myself, and I can go and do an nmap sniff of everybody who's running Django and say, all right, now I've got an in on that company or this company or something like that, right? The blast radius is now much, much bigger than I can harass a maintainer of an open source repository.
That's really interesting. It almost feels like the way that you're describing it, it almost feels like maybe that's the next, I think for me of like the evolution of, I think we talked about it recently, of ransomware, right? Meaning like, hey, here's a new way of thinking about this. We don't need to like steal information. We can just like break stuff and then get people to pay us for it. And this feels like it might be the next level of like, yeah, we never thought about it that way, but now we can do a new kind of crime. And that's really what it boils down to. But like, crime is as old as the world, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And if what they say about Mythos is true, that it is capable enough that it can string together multiple vulnerabilities and multiple disparate pieces of software to find a root exploit. Again, the blast radius is not just the maintainers of a particular application. It's anybody who has it exposed in their stacks.
Indeed. And you kind of touched on that like a couple of minutes ago. When you'd think of the impact towards private companies, right? Like a company that builds their own software. I feel like today the easy statement that could be made is, look, Mythos is probably going to be great at doing, source-based analysis. Reverse engineering tends to be kind of one level up. Do you think it's a temporary thing, which I suspect it is, or do you think it's just kind of like a progression, and that's the next step that we're going to start seeing more and more?
Depends on what you're reverse engineering, right? Am I reverse engineering a binary, or I'm reverse engineering your deployment environment? One misconfigured IAM permission and I could have a lot more access than you think, especially if now I have the ability to look at what's deployed in your Kubernetes or something like that. You may say my vault or etcd is secure, and it probably is, but what about the host underneath it? Can I send a malicious crafted network packet and get access to the host, and then maybe I can exfiltrate your keys stored in Vault securely. Now, granted, we have defense in depth, which hopefully protects against a lot of these things, but suppose it's a year and now I've got 50 qubits instead of 40 qubits. I don't know how to deal with this. I really don't. This is what
It
keeps me up at
almost,
night.
yeah, it feels a little bit like, the I think for anybody that's gotten into computer science in some way at some point, right? At some point, the aha moment of, oh my God, it's just 1,000 layers of indirection like abstraction over the other, and this is just a castle made of cards, right? And I feel like, is this the moment where this is finally catching up to us, where we kind of sucked as humans to do the reverse engineering, but now that robots do it, it turns out they're amazing at just breaking that whole house of cards down, you know?
The assumption I've always had in security, and I'm sure this will be no surprise to anybody here at all, is that it's not a matter of if, but when. And so all of our work, not all of our work, but so much of work needs to be in containing the damage, being able to detect it, being able to audit it, being able to think about, all right, even if somebody did exfiltrate my database full of passwords, I am using something like bcrypt. For very short-lived tokens, I'm using something like Argon2 or better for long-lived tokens. And I'm looking at what post-quantum cryptography looks like there, just because, rainbow tables have been a thing for many, many years, and computers have been getting faster for many, many years, and we've just got to retire some of these algorithms. Again, that's how I keep thinking about it, is it is an arms race, and we have now seen a leap from splitting the atom to dropping the atom in terms of these models, if again, what we are hearing about Mythos is believable.
Quantum cryptography is an order of magnitude more scary than AI and security, which is already scary enough. I almost don't want to talk about it, given just how completely brutal it is.
No, right? Because we've been acting, okay, someday our database tables full of hashed, salted passwords will leak, but oh goodness, at least nobody can break elliptic curve cryptography. And well, that may not be true anymore.
That's right. That's right. It's I feel like it's probably going to be a Manhattan Project kind of level of, change to the dynamics of the world, right? To the politics, to everything, when all this information is, anyway,
And these things aren't
you
going away, right? We are not giving up the benefits of using open source for like 85, 90% of our stacks. We are not giving up the benefit of containerization, being able to build images and deploy them. And, we are not giving up the benefit of being able to generate code very quickly from a specification and having, red, green, test-driven development agents, sub-agents working against each other. The cat is not going back in the bag.
So that's an interesting statement because I completely agree with you today. At the same time, I feel like we have not started to suffer the true consequences of AI being widely able being able to use for hacking, for like breaches to vulnerabilities to all of that stuff. So that ROI is going to eventually shift. And I suspect that that in the long term, like you're completely correct. It's an interesting thought experiment to say, like, what if it doesn't? And it turns
Right.
out that it's just too hard. And we just can't make it do it safely. And it's a little bit, so you've lived the 90s, right? Like and the internet and all that. It's like the old suggestion, like, hey, if you go in a coffee shop, right, you need to have a VPN. And before HTTPS was common and secure. Which is a very different internet than it is today, like in terms of how people feel about it, right?
Yeah, I remember being in the room when Dan Kaminsky revealed his DNS attack, and it was just like my eyebrows kept going up and up and up. I'm thinking, okay, and then yeah, it turned out to be a lot simpler than we thought. So the notion of everybody is trustworthy on the internet wasn't true back in 1981 when SMTP was developed.
That's fair, that's fair.
But I
So,
also don't want to live in a world where the red team wins 51% of the time.
as opposed
Let
to
alone
95% of the time
52 or
today.
exactly, right? I'd love to see it go down, but I don't want to be in a world where it wins even more than 50% of the time.
Right. Yeah, no, that's very true. And on that topic, do you have thoughts for organizations today? Like maybe it's open source people, maybe it's like companies building software. You've had some lessons learned right now that I think a lot of people haven't had. Do you have some words of wisdom onto like, hey, you probably want to think about it this way, and maybe you want to be ready and have this thing, that kind of stuff.
I think, three lessons that aren't immediately obvious. Immediately obvious is it's not if but when, but everybody here knows that. I think the first one is, look for the adversarial approach. If you are using AI-driven development or analysis or things like that, play these things off of each other because everybody comes from a different perspective, everybody comes from a different context, and you get more benefit from asking not just how do I build this thing quickly, but how do I break this thing and make it better? So that's step one. Step two for all of the software using organization, especially open source, but not anything, it's important to understand what you have and why, right? If you end up seeing that you've got a version of OpenSSL that has been out of date for 2 or 3 years, that is a vulnerable point. And anybody who is looking in your organization can find it. You should assume that that will be easier and easier to find and break it. But the third thing is, even though we are going to have more and more 0 days come out here, you don't always have to be on the bleeding edge, right? The other things we've seen that we haven't even talked about here are supply chain attacks on PyPI or NPM. Sahi-Hulud is very sophisticated. It is making the long play. It is going to continue to make the long play. So it's okay to stay a couple of weeks behind there, but you're going to have to know what's in your organization and why to be able to make that decision. And again, that could be a discussion for 2 or 3 of these sessions, for sure. That stuff is fascinating.
Yes, absolutely. That's yeah, th those are definitely two huge forces going diametrically opposed. Interesting challenge. Thank you for coming in. That was super interesting. I think it's a discussion we're probably going to have again in 6 months, and it's going to be a completely different, different
or 3 months or 2 months.
That's right. That's right. But yeah, that was great. If folks want to get in touch with you, is there a better way to do that?
I'm available on my LinkedIn. You can look for Shane Warden on LinkedIn, Shane Warden at Active State there. Happy to chat there. Happy to make connections.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much. And thanks, everybody. We will see everybody next week for Defender Fridays.
That brings us to the end of another Defender Fridays discussion. Support our show by sharing your favorite episodes with a friend, subscribe or give us a rating on whatever podcast platform you're listening from. If you want to be a part of the conversation and join us live, you can register at limacharlie.io/defender-fridays. Thanks for listening in, and we'll see you in the next one. The Cybersecurity Defenders podcast is hosted and produced by Christopher Luft. The show is co-produced and edited by Sam Blake with graphics by Amr Al-Khatib. Sponsored by Lima Charlie, scalable infrastructure for your security services. Visit limacharlie.io to get started for free.